and pack up the tent and drive on to the next town and do the same thing the next night. I mean, some of us complain about life on the road, having had to fly from California or from Hartford or whatever, but it was nothing compared to that kind of grueling pace. And you can imagine what the roads were like back then, too. So Lester and Earl got tired of it and left the band, and a couple months later decided that maybe they would play together. And so they started a band called Flat and Scruggs and the Foggy Mountain Boys. The Foggy Mountain Boys, was their theme song was taken from that Carter Family song that I played you, the Monroe Brothers doing, the Foggy Mountain Top. And they played that as their theme song for a while. And they ended up working at the same radio station in Bristol as the Stanley Brothers. And that, it's questionable, that's obviously where Ralph Stanley learned to play that style of banjo, although he denies it. He says he learned it from Snuffy Jenkins. But what's really interesting is that in 1947, Bill Monroe recorded that song I just played you, Molly and Ten Brooks. But it wasn't released on the Columbia label until 1949. In the meantime, the Stanley Brothers listened real hard to that and put out a record of it in 1948 in exactly the same style. And I'll play you a little of that. And unusual for them, they got their mandolin player, Ralph Stanley, who was unbelievable, one of the legendary high singers in bluegrass. He was the banjo player, so he wasn't free to play the banjo and sing the high part at the same time. So like Monroe's band, they had the mandolin player, Pee Wee Lambert, sing the song. And you'll hear a little of that. Bill was very upset about this. Is what we think of as a style of music, bluegrass, now, it wasn't a style. It was his music. It was his band sound. And back then, your band sound was, that's what people came to hear. It was your style and your sound, and it was special to him. So he was pretty upset, and he was particularly upset because he was on the Columbia label. And right after this Molly and Ten Brooks came out, the Stanley Brothers, the Columbia label signed the Stanley Brothers. So Bill said, forget it, and left Columbia. This is in about 1948-49. So to me, this is like the record that is the point of departure for bluegrass music as a style. From it being the music of one man and one man's vision, all of a sudden you have bands beginning to copy the sound. And the next step, the people who copied it to par excellence and developed it as, to what we really identify as bluegrass, was Flat and Scruggs. And they were on the Mercury label, and signed in 1948 to about 1950, and I'll play you a little of one of their hits. It's just really great, hard-driving bluegrass. If you've heard any bluegrass, you doubtless have heard this song.
Hey, man.
that just swings like crazy, and everything is in place, and it's the backup, the banjo backup is so exciting. It's like, I love the singing, but I can almost not even listen to the singing from, you know, how great the banjo was. And Earl developed that, you know, in that period. I don't think it's, you know, ever been, it certainly hasn't been surpassed by any banjo player. It always amazes me that somebody comes along to invent something, and you know, and he's the greatest at it. And he's the greatest at it in 1948, and here we are, you know, in 1984, still looking for it, you know. 1985. Lose a year. Right, I lost a year. What happened in 1984? I'll play you a little of an instrumental number that Flatt and Scruggs did in the same time. Again, they were back on the road doing the same thing, doing shows in little courthouses, carrying around a tent. They didn't have a baseball team, but it was the same grueling pace. They were on the Opry, so often what they had to do was play a show on Saturday night at Opry, go out and play a round of one-nighters, and they would go thousands of miles away, and wherever they did, they had to be back the next week to play in the Opry again. It's a rough life. Anyway, this is one of an instrumental called Farewell Blues. I'll just play a little of that. Now that was that song was taken from the swing genre, I believe, and adapted to bluegrass. It was also recorded by Hawaiian bands, which were kind of periodically had a following in the States. People liked that kind of music, and there's a recording that I've heard by Saul Hoopi, who played slide guitar, it's actually pretty similar. You can hear that Earl took some licks from that. I'm going to move ahead a little. By the mid 1950s, the Flatt and Scruggs band sound was pretty complete. They had, in an effort to get a different sound than Monroe, they pretty much downplayed the mandolin. They didn't have very many mandolin breaks in their records. They usually carried a mandolin player, Curly Seckler, but he took very few solos. And around 1955, I think it was, they added the dobro guitar to their band. And maybe I get Stacy to say something about that.
Back in those days, many of the players knew each other. Buck Graves was playing with a band that came from the Roy Acuff style of playing music, which had there was another strand of other strands of old timey music still going on and progressing, changing their sound from the old Hawaiian sound and sort of mixed in with old time music, and there was a strand of that kind of music happening, and Roy Acuff sort of modernized that sound a little bit. And of course, there were offshoots of Roy Acuff, and Buck Graves was playing with Wilma Lee and Stone Cooper, sort of a band in the Roy Acuff style. And he eventually, he knew Scruggs, who taught him to play a little bit the dobro in sort of a loop, three-finger style. And as I believe he was, he actually was playing bass with Latin Scruggs for a few months. And Scruggs really liked the sound of the dobro, so they asked him to play it a couple of times, and it worked out well enough for them to just hire another bass player.
Yeah, and he went on, and in by the 60s, I mean, to me, he was really the creative force in that band. Earl had sort of, his playing was, didn't have the same jump and bite to it, that, but Buck Graves really did.
He was a wild man.
Yeah, and here's, this is a live cut of them, Flattened Strokes on the Radio in about 1958, I think, and this is their one of the, you know, just a classic band sound, a song called Head Over Heels in Love With You.
I just got to forget you if I can. Oh, I'm feeling so blue, I don't know what to do, because I'm head over heels in love with you. Thinking of you only. Oh, I just can't sleep when I lay down.
Boy, let me play a little more Uncle Josh, actually. There's one more cut of him, if I can find it quickly.
From now on, let me hang
around. Oh, yeah. This is a you know, a commercial record, and the dobro is doing great backup.
From now on, I won't be hanging around. From now
that's
on, I won't be hanging around. I've taken all I can, go find another man. From now on, I won't be hanging around.
Yeah, you can make funny sounds in the dobro. Well, I could go on here, or I could take questions. Are there people have questions that come to mind? So I've been doing this. This has been a little over an hour, and it's hot in here. So I'd like to answer some questions.
I would like to know at what point and what the influence was. To me, it just seemed to happen overnight when they stopped calling hillbilly music hillbilly music and start calling it country western. What happened and when?
Well, that happened, I happened to just be reading that. I think that happened in 1944. And what it was basically the change, it came about in the commercial trade magazines. That Billboard magazine, which had a hillbilly section, started calling that country and western music. They just thought hillbilly is a derogatory term. They figured that out.
They started to add the western swing and the California
right.
hillbilly music, and they started calling it country
and western. Right.
They just put them in one
line. Western swing, there was a big western swing craze going on with Bob Wills, and so that's how it ended up being country and western. But that was about, you know, during the war. They were, I guess they were sensitive to some of these social issues and decided they would change the category.
I guess that answers my concern, because I felt like I had sort of done a Rip Van Winkle and I missed the whole thing. And I guess I was in the service when that happened.
Uh-huh, well.
And when I got back, it was called Country West.
Well, there we have corroboration.
Do To what an extent the dobro guitar replaced the banjo as country music developed?
Well, do you want to talk about that?
The dobro's grandson, the pedal steel, has completely replaced the banjo, and it's replaced the dobro too. It was a conscious effort in the late 50s for the powers that be in Nashville to make the music more palatable to a wider audience. And so the banjo was one of the first things that had to go. And the fiddle also, you know, fiddle players were out of work and the banjo players were out of work. And in fact, eventually, you know, it got to nowadays where the steel, you don't even hear the pedal steel so much anymore, at least some sort of music. But as far as the dobro and the banjo, in Flat and Scruggs, there was a point where Earl Scruggs was sick for a long time, and Buck Rays, being the other hot player in the band, got to play a lot more. But I don't know if that was really just a conscious effort, that it just happened that way.
Yeah, I think it happened. But I think that what happened back then was, again, this question of urbanization, that you had people playing music in clubs and bars, and they just found that the amplified music with drums was, people would dance to it more easily in the cities, whereas bluegrass was not as dance wasn't, you can't close dance bluegrass, you know, and so that didn't sell the beer or sell the records or get people in the clubs so much, so the recording industry sort of is always one step behind following. I think that's sort of what influenced that.
Is dobro a guitar?
It is a guitar, yeah.
Yeah, it's a guitar with the strings raised so that you don't press the strings down with your fingers. You use a piece of metal.
Right here.
So the dobro is a guitar with the strings raised and you play it with a slide. This fellow has one here.
Yeah. The dobro is just a brand name that's become generic.
Stand up.
It's a, comes from the Hawaiian tradition. The Hawaiian plays, all this is spaghetti over here. Basically, the dobro is a steel guitar, which means you play it with a piece of steel and you don't press the strings down. If you notice, the strings are about 3/4 of an inch.
Play something, Stacy. Can you?
I
bet he's...
And some Czechoslovakian immigrants about 1927 wanted to make a loud guitar.
They did.
So they took the, basically what was a diaphragm of a phonograph speaker and plopped it in here and started fooling around with it. And there's a thin piece of metal that resonates when you play it. And sort of gives it a unique tone. And he just wanted to have a regular guitar. It wasn't made to be a Hawaiian guitar. And a few months after he invented that, a microphone was invented, so it was immediately obsolete. it fell down the cracks of music into bluegrass music.
Just show him a little what it sounds like.
In the late 20s, Hawaiian music was still somewhat of a craze in the States, and so they started making, if you can see, there's a square neck, you can't even get your fingers around. So it just, it's become connected with Hawaiian guitar. But there still are some regular dobros around that you can play with the regular style.
What does the Wheeling Jamboree come into all this?
The same, it was one of those, shows like WSM, like the Grand Ole Opry.
But it didn't, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. It was a big deal. That was
when I visited in Canada years and years and years ago, and they said, West Virginia, oh, it's a jamboree.
Well, what the reason for that is that
Strong radio station.
You had these things called clear channels, where these stations had 50,000 watts, and they didn't put other local stations near them. So they could broadcast really far. That was what some of the first country music I heard, and I grew up outside New York City, was the jamboree on WWVA.
At 1 o'clock in the morning, the other channels that were near it would go off the air, and I would hear Lee Morris. And
Lee Moore, the coffee drinking.
WWVA, and late at night they wouldn't be playing the commercial music. You'd hear some bluegrass and stuff.
Yeah.
Live from the Alex and Ola Bell's grocery store.
Right.
Who would you say today would be the real devotees, the fans of the Flatten Scruggs bluegrass style? I mean, is it still, does the Opry do it? And in cities, are there any sizable numbers of people?
I think it's an interesting question. I live in California, which is not exactly bluegrass country, and I play in a couple of bands. Lori plays in a band. I lived in upstate New York. I think it's pretty much spread throughout the country. There's lots of bluegrass bands in Canada. They called me. I'm going to Europe to play bluegrass next week. You know, I mean, and we're going to Europe. The banjo player that I'm going to Europe with is Japanese.
Oh.
So it's pretty universal. But if I had to say where the music is rooted, it's still in the Southeast, where they play it to me with, through Ohio and down through the Southeast, where they play it with the greatest intensity, and it's still closer to their lives. Paul Silvius, who is teaching banjo here, plays with Del McCurry and the Dixie Pals, and I just spent a couple days hanging around with them. People in?
On campus, is college campus.
Not too much, I don't think.
What's the problem? What was the problem of going from two fingers to three fingers?
The problem is that you, with three finger picking on the banjo, you're actually setting up a repeating pattern, and that you have to coordinate the notes of your left hand with the notes of your right hand and fit everything into a roll in order to get this rolling rhythm. That you really wanted to get an even rhythm that articulated each note the same way. Whereas the two finger picking it just has a more ragged sound. You can't get the same kind of smoothness that way. I'm not a banjo player, so I can't really demonstrate, but maybe Paul can if he's around later.
One of the things that happen when you start playing three finger style is that the bluegrass music is usually in a count of four, and when you're playing with a three finger roll, you're setting up a pattern of three against four, which gives you a certain syncopation, which is a lot more difficult to get with two fingers. So that was one of the sounds that really came out when Earl Scruggs started playing, and it's a certain brain set that you have to start hearing.
Yeah, it puts everything into a certain rhythmic mold, which is what some people don't like about bluegrass, but it's also what people really do like about it.
Can you make a few comments about what's happened since the late 50s until now, the progressive bluegrass movements? Are there any innovative techniques or people doing different things?
There are people who have been innovative on the different instruments. I think that the most innovation has come about, to my mind, on the guitar and the banjo. That using the banjo, there are some astounding banjo players like Tony Trischka and Bela Fleck and some other friends of ours, Marty Cutler, and people who are just playing music on the banjo instead of being confined to playing bluegrass music. And on the guitar, people have learned how to work with the instrument so that it'll project the sound instead of it just playing rhythm. But there's, always room for better musicianship all the time, and I think that people are always working on their technique and working on ideas, but the risk that you run is of, at least if you're talking about bluegrass music as a style that comes from a certain culture, is you put too much other stuff in it, it's not bluegrass anymore. But you have innovations with new acoustic music and David Grisman's music and things that are really exciting people now, and that are based on bluegrass techniques or a certain kind of bluegrass ensemble playing.
I would say bluegrass not only is a commercial kind of music, it's almost like a participatory sport.
Right.
I mean, everywhere you go, there's clubs, and you can take part in bands in the park. You don't have to have big amplifiers, just grab your instrument, go out wherever the meeting is.
Right.
It's really just a people's kind of a phenomenon.
Right. And the people, unlike rock and roll or country and western people, the people who love it often tend to play it. And, you know, with all different degrees of skill, but, you know, they all will try it, and it really is participatory in that way. That's how I started, you know. I mean, I heard it, and we just got together little bands in 1961 or something like that, and it was fun to do it together, you know.
What about the name Bluegrass?
The name Bluegrass, as I was saying, there's a scholarly debate going on about how it became a genre. As I said, the name Bluegrass, as two words, was the name of Bill Monroe's band. And I suspect that what happened is, you know, people getting together said, what do you play that Bluegrass Boys kind of music, or that, you know, that bluegrass style of music? And somewhere in the 1950s, it became, you know, sort of the generic name for the style of music. But it's one of those things that's lost in the haze of some bar room, probably, you know, where that word came to be used.
A couple of short questions about things you've mentioned. You talked about the development of from old time music in which everybody played together to bluegrass, and which sort of have rotating leads.
Right.
There are people who hold. I'm not one of them because I don't get shot from a bluegrass crowd, but that this sort of revolving lead has led to the star system in bluegrass, which sort of tends to, for some people, to detract from the group feeling. Can you comment on that from your own experience?
Well, I would say it's, you know, it's not all one way or the other. That bluegrass began, the whole emphasis on having on commercial country music, you had stars. Stars were what sold records. Stars were what sold tickets. That what they found was that bands didn't so much, but if you had Bill Monroe coming, or if you had Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt coming, they were the stars. And the other band members, they could be great musicians and really add to the music, but they weren't initially what drew people. They wanted to hear, you know, they wanted to see their star. And it's just like Michael Jackson, you know, or you know, any pop star who hires the best musicians he can to play along with him. And those people make his music in a certain way, but people are coming to see the star. They identify with the star.
How about the notion of parking lot stars?
What do you mean?
Well, there's a lot of competition in bluegrass for who knows the latest lick, who knows the hottest thing, who can play the fastest, and so forth. I mean, these are the sorts of things that you'll hear said about bluegrass.
Oh, yeah. The notion of parking lot stars. Well, there's a lot of competitiveness in bluegrass music. I wish, in a way, that there was less. On the other hand, it's a kind of test, and it forges your musicianship in a certain way to hang in there. And the people who are great parking lot pickers tend to be no different. There's not a big step between being a great parking lot picker and playing in a good band. It's the same music, you know. And it's just, the great parking lot pickers are the people who perhaps wisely have decided to make their living in some other way, you know.
Speaking about that, is the commercial well-being of the guys who cut records better?
Forget it. You know, they're at the top, there are a few people who are making a fair amount of money and making a good living. At the just workaday level, it's a job. I mean, Paul is in a professional band, and, you know, they have to work hard to make a living. And some of us have other jobs at different points, but it's, you know, to be just a full-time musician, it's, you know, it's like working in an auto shop or like working any other kind of job. It's hard hours and hard work, and, you know, very few people who are making much money at it.
Would you you just develop shortly, when you were talking about listening to people in the South, or certain parts of the South, and you used the phrase where the music is close to their lives, as opposed, I suppose, to some other people that it's, that what, and that's what I, that's the point.
Well, what, for example, it's like I play once or twice a week in a bar in California, in San Francisco, and play in good bands that are playing good traditional bluegrass. The people who come in who really like it, first are musicians, then the people who really like it, who you get the best feedback from, are the people who come from the East a lot. You know, and they really respond to it in an emotionally direct way. And like the other day going with Paul to hear Dale McCurry's band in this bar in outside Baltimore, the music was really, you could tell, it was really part of their lives. They danced, which doesn't happen in California. They just took it as another form of country music and would dance to it. They related to it very personally. They knew the music and they knew the musicians. And the musicians who played it were no different than the people in the audience, except that they happened to be up there playing. So I think there's no distance. And that's always been a feature of country music to me. I think it's a lot of it is lost now in commercial country music, but I think that people felt that, always felt that country music, the singers were their voice, were speaking for them in some way, and they really identified with them really closely. Bluegrass, which began as a form of commercial country music, but now I see it as a, it's more, and in economic terms, it's more marginal. You won't hear it, you know, unless you live around Washington, D.C., you won't hear it on the radio almost any place. Whereas, you know, you'll get lots of country music. And the country music that you hear now is, to me, real smoothed out. It doesn't have any, you know, yeah, it has certain kinds of supposed, you know, rural or country values, but it's very formulaic to me and very musically smoothed out. There are no rough edges left on it. There's no rawness to it. But that's a matter of my personal taste, you know. You may not agree.
Helen, thanks a lot.
Thank you for coming and sitting here. Oh.